get out of here. And you are rolling.
Thank you. Today is October 19th, 2016. I'm local historian Tom Arnold interviewing Dick Rainey at the Lawrence Public Library for the City of Lawrence Fair Housing Ordinance 50th Anniversary Oral History Project. At the time the ordinance passed in July 1967, Mayor Rainey was serving as a city commissioner and as the mayor of Lawrence, and as mayor, he signed the ordinance. Mayor Rainey, I'd like to start off by having you tell me a little bit about your early background, including what brought you to Lawrence and what you were doing here in the mid-1960s.
I was a middle 30s pharmacist, owner of 3 drugstores in Lawrence. Beyond that, decided to run for the city commission and served 4 years, did not choose to run for re-election. Got sort of busy.
Okay. And you had told me before that you came to Lawrence to attend KU and then stayed, or had you moved here before that?
I really stayed. Came here from Osborne, Kansas, my hometown, and skipped my senior year in high school thinking that World War II might be demanding of my presence and that maybe a year at KU before getting drafted would be helpful. As it is, the war was over a month before I matriculated.
Okay.
Stuttered.
And was your degree in pharmacy?
In business.
In business, okay. And so you opened the pharmacy after you graduated?
Yeah, 3, actually, in the first decade of my being here. Yeah.
Okay, great. Where did you live at the time? I know you had mentioned that you, after you were married, you and your wife moved into a neighborhood up near Iowa.
We lived across from the 4-H grounds for the first year and a half of our marriage. Then we had 2 children, Michelle in 54, Rich in 55, and moved to my current address, 5 Westwood Road in Lawrence.
Okay. And was that in an all-white neighborhood at that time?
Oh, certainly.
Okay. And would you how would you kind of characterize Lawrence at that time in terms of the degrees of segregation and some of the observable discrimination?
Well, certainly economically and residentially, very segregated.
You had mentioned that as a pharmacist, many African Americans were customers of yours because of your willingness to work with them and provide them credit as needed, and that gave you some insights into the African-American community and their struggles. Can you describe that a little bit?
Provided me with quite an education. There are 4 other drugstores in downtown Lawrence at that point in time, and having a very tiny little drugstore to begin with, I was finding it very difficult to establish clientele. And some blacks came in and needed some credit. I offered them, and they were uniformly punctual and reliable, and friendships formed as a result of that relationship.
So how would you describe some of the struggles that they faced in the 1950s and the levels of and types of discrimination?
Just what we think is a classic lack of opportunity. The top jobs, there was not a black serving the public in downtown retail Lawrence at that point in time, and for a number of years following that, even. It was a low-wage country.
And so for many African Americans, were they, in that era in the 50s, denied even access to certain businesses? And
there were no haircuts, no food service. There were no downtown restaurants, maybe out of city limits restaurants that would serve a black.
Hmm. And I assume it was observable by the housing segregation that kind of discrimination carried over into housing as well at the time.
Well, and just the principle that blacks will not be served food at a restaurant in Lawrence. When Wilt Chamberlain came here, I think in 1957, that was still true.
Hmm. You mentioned that you served from 65 to 69 on the city commission. What inspired you to run in 1965?
I thought there were certain delinquencies Lawrence as a community was not offering the broader community base. Certainly a swimming pool among them. I thought less of the fair housing aspect, and yet that became a very important item on my agenda before long at all. So if I had a single incentive to run for the city commission, it was to tend to level the playing field.
Great. We had talked also earlier about at your pharmacy, kind of a cross-section of community leaders and others in the town would gather there for breakfast, and you'd talk about the issues of the day. Did these kind of issues come up in your discussions then?
You know, not so very much. When these things were formalized in terms of votable issues, whether it be just the commission or the larger community in the case of the swimming pool, then those were issues almost exclusively talked of. But prior to that time, memory fails me. We had a lot of fun, but I don't know what we talked about.
Okay, fair enough. You only served from 65 to 69. Why did you decide not to run again? You had mentioned just...
I was busy.
Just life.
I had the drug stores here and interests in Emporia, Coffeyville, Fort Scott, Ottawa.
Right. Were you pleased with what you accomplished during your 4 years?
Oh, I would love to have been able to serve longer. But I think my primary mission had been at least partially served.
Okay. I'm going to get, before we get into a more detailed discussion of the fair housing and your time on the City Commission, I just want to ask you again some general questions about what Lawrence was like in that era. How would you describe, you know, you've talked a little bit about the kind of discrimination that was apparent, but how would you describe kind of the tenor of race relations between the white and the black community at that time?
Well, I think it was best described by an industrialist a meeting occurred even after I was off the commission, and the industrialist said that when a patrol car cruised East Lawrence, all the black children waved at the policeman, and some black in the back of the room said, well, if you didn't wave, you got hit over the head. And that probably well described a fundamental problem.
Right. Now, obviously, by the late 60s, early 70s, racial tension kind of broke out into some unfortunate violence in Lawrence. But earlier in the decade, in the 60s, did you sense that kind of building frustration and tension within the black community?
Not prior to 65. By 67, anti-Vietnam sentiments were running very, very high, particularly at the university level, because those were the students most affected. They were going to Vietnam, and too many of them were getting killed.
And did you see, did you have a sense that there was kind of an intersection between the two issues, kind of the race issues and the Vietnam protest issues?
As a tertiary thing, but not a primary.
Okay. And how about the protests at the university? Obviously, you know, reflected issues related to Vietnam and probably kind of a reflection of national racial issues. But as a local issue and the concerns of local African-American residents, what would you say were some of their key frustrations in that time frame? You've mentioned the swimming pool as one.
Basic services. They were remiss. I think the larger, older black population were not particularly expecting that kind of thing. The younger people were beginning to understand better segregation, what was happening to them that their parents might not have accepted, but they wondered whether they should accept those
right.
things.
And it's interesting you bring that up, but one of the previous interviewers interviews that I conducted, the interviewee mentioned that the high school was kind of a hotbed of of racial frustration among some of the African-American students. Did you have a sense of that or observe any of that?
It permeated the entire community, and it focused around the high school. There were some very articulate black voices being heard and stimulating. Well, the need for one black cheerleader seemed to be outrageous in certain areas of the white community. It seemed very reasonable when most of the starting football players, or at least half of them, were black and they couldn't have one black cheerleader.
Right.
It was purely offensive.
Yeah. We mentioned talked a little bit about the pool, but in 1960 there was an initial protest by a number of African Americans over denial of access to the Jayhawk Plunge, which was a private pool, but frustration that there was no public pool available to them and that they couldn't have access to the private pool. Did those protests, what was the reaction of kind of people generally in Lawrence over those protests, and was there concern that this was the beginning of a larger movement that would continue?
I don't know that the thought was it was going to be a larger issue in the future. It was a very painful issue focused on that very thing. A lady owned the Jayhawk, or the Plunge, whatever it was called, and denied blacks the option of paying their 25 cents in swimming. And the community had some articulate voices supporting the ladies being able to discriminate on that basis. Others rose up against that thesis.
What would you say in general terms were the primary impediments to bringing about change, or any or groups within the community that were most resistant to change, and what their motives were?
I don't know that they were groups as such. I think the Klan existed in Lawrence at that point in time. I would like to minimize the Klan's influence on community affairs, and yet maybe the Klan had some influence. But there were articulate voices that were as segregationist as Alabama ever dreamed of being, Georgia or Mississippi.
Right. And would you say that was just kind of a cross-section of the community among some people who had particularly
Well, I would think numerically those segregationist voices were few, but they happened to be loud.
Okay.
And in some cases quite influential in the affairs of the community.
And others may have been reluctant to stand up to them or speak out against them because of the fearing of being singled out or ostracized or targeted.
Well, it didn't seem like there were enough integrationists being heard at that point in time.
Right. One group that seems to have gotten involved as we look at some of the community organizations that were fighting discriminatory practices were often associated with the university, faculty members, students. To what extent would you say that the presence of the university in Lawrence helped to spur change by making people more aware of some of these issues and why they needed to be reversed or changed?
I think the best example of that would be Franklin Murphy, then the chancellor of Kansas University, later the president of UCLA, and then the president of the Los Angeles Times. But at the time he was here, he gathered the restaurant owners of Lawrence together and made a pronouncement that if they didn't start serving blacks as they served whites, that the KU Union was going to start serving T-bone steaks at a price that they couldn't compete with. And suddenly, almost all the restaurants in Lawrence opened up their doors to the black community.
Right. And the impetus for that meeting between him and the restaurant owners has actually been related to us. It was Wilt Chamberlain, Homer Floyd, Charlie Tidwell, and the other name is escaping me, a fourth athlete. They actually went and met with the chancellor and threatened to leave school if he didn't address that issue. But it sounded
Gale Sayers was a member of that group.
But it sounds as if that had a real meaningful impact.
Economics became an issue with regard to restaurant owners.
Right. Do you remember any specific incidents or problems that might have motivated some people to start taking action and addressing issues, such as, I mean, obviously that meeting of the athletes with Chancellor Murphy was one example, but does anything else come to mind in those early years of things that really stirred some people to action, particular events?
I think just getting the attention of the white community, the vast majority of whom were not objecting to the integrated nature of this community, that the community should be more integrated, just came to mind. It was not a preconceived thing,
right?
But it seemed so reasonable to the vast majority, not to everyone. And to those that didn't seem to accept that, they seemed to have the loudest voices.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I don't know whether you recall, but at the time, the Human Relations Commission was working on the Fair Housing Ordinance before they actually presented it to the City Commission. A signature drive was conducted to try and get people to sign a statement that they supported integrated housing in Lawrence, and over 1,000 people signed it. So a pretty substantial portion of the population of a relatively small town. Would that then not have surprised you that number of people were willing to speak out?
You remind me of that. I'd long since forgotten it. I don't think I was surprised at that.
Yeah.
That someone had the energy and the integrity to make that petition a petition was maybe the surprising thing.
Right. And it's interesting if you look at, and the city is actually plotted out, because the signatures or the names of supporters that was published in the Journal World included their addresses, and the city plotted out where all those addresses were, and it was actually quite widely dispersed throughout Lawrence, so it makes it appear that there was pretty widespread support for those kinds of changes, which must have been encouraging to those of you who thought such changes were needed.
I'd almost forgotten about that.
Yeah. Did you ever feel any pressure as a member of the City Commission from some people, or even as a business owner who worked with the, you know, who welcomed the black community as customers? Did you feel pressure from certain segments to not be as willing to make changes that would be beneficial to African Americans or to do business with African Americans?
Not so much doing business, but incorporating African Americans into your service corps, whether it be a waiter, a waitress, someone behind a cosmetic counter, or somebody mixing a chocolate ice cream soda. That's where the black community was noticeably missing. And they wanted jobs, but they knew better than to apply.
Interesting. You had mentioned, and I found it fascinating because it's maybe not a recognized element of the story, of Tiger Dowdell, who obviously was tragically shot in some of the violence, but that he had worked for you at one point.
He was our evening delivery man.
Okay.
Very popular with the girls that he hauled across the campus with our delivery vehicle.
Because he gave them rides?
Yeah. Free rides.
Yeah, great. Did you have other African-American employees?
Yes.
And did you feel any pressure or take any criticism over hiring, having, you know, racially neutral hiring practices?
Certainly no criticism directed at me. I probably was a little too big and too frightening to be affected that way.
Okay. In addition to your position on the City Commission, as well as your role as obviously a fairly prominent businessman, were you involved in any other community organizations that tried to promote ends to discrimination or address discriminatory practices?
Not prior to my service on the commission. Post-commission, I was on the Ballard Board, headquarters, Cottonwood, KANU, the university radio station, a number of university committees. Yeah.
Right. Now, when we talked earlier and again, you don't need to mention any names whatsoever, but you had mentioned one incident when you were having lunch at the Eldridge Hotel of hearing something that kind of helped to motivate you to want to serve in the city commission and make a change in the community. Can you relate that story to me?
This was fully a year before I declared my candidacy, and I ran away from the drugstore once or twice a month and was able to have lunch at the Red Slipper Room in the Eldridge Hotel. And the place was very busy, and the maitre d' said there was one table of four with two guys sitting there, and he would check with them, and it was okay with them if I sat with them. And I sort of knew them, and I sort of didn't. But they were two leading Lawrence industrialists. And speaking of the swimming pool in this regard, not the Fair Housing Ordinance, the darkies could swim in the river. They didn't drown very often anyway, did they? And that was defensive of the lady who wanted to eliminate or deny blacks access to her swimming pool. Mm. It gave me a sense of despair. I had two young children at that time. I didn't want to grow up that way. Mm.
So definitely that was when you decided to run for the commission. Incidents were in your mind and were the kind of symptomatic of the sort of changes you wanted to bring about.
Some 2 years later, perhaps, and I was then newly elected to the commission, Chancellor Wesco brought me a letter that one of those two men had addressed to the chancellor and saying exactly the same thing. Well, why don't we just have them buy their own swimming pool if they want to go swimming? And he said, Dick, can you do anything about that? I said, well, that's about 89% of the reason I ran for the commission.
Interesting. You'd also related to me an incident where someone came to your pharmacy one day and made kind of a veiled threat about the Klan possibly not being happy with some of the things you were doing. Can you just relate that again? Again, no names need to be mentioned.
Well, that was about it. He was a dedicated customer and patient, and I was surprised that he addressed me on that score because he knew me well enough to know where I stood. But he told me candidly that some of the Klan members were terribly disappointed in me. They were my patients and customers in many cases. And he said, Dick, would you like to see a list of them? And he pulled a list out of his pocket. And I said, no, I think I'll be very happy to sleep very tight tonight and not know their names. Mm. Now I'm sorry I didn't. I didn't look at that list.
Was that while you were a member of the city commission, or was that before?
Okay. Yes, that was. Yeah, that was when we were dealing with those issues,
right.
Fair housing, swimming pool.
So clearly there were some people in town who weren't necessarily happy with the
terribly
direction.
Terribly unhappy.
Yeah. That's disappointing to hear, but not surprising, I guess. When you became a member of the commission, you've already mentioned the swimming pool, but what particular issues were you most concerned about and most hopeful that you could bring about positive change?
You know, I don't think I had a long-range view beyond those issues we've already visited concerning. We were interested in better streets, but these were mechanical things. We had a gifted city manager, Ray Wells. Ray, incidentally, was a spiritual guide in our efforts to create the Fair Housing Ordinance and the swimming pool. He offered us lovely guidance. Ray was a far-seeking, far-looking manager, knowing what he thought we should be thinking about in terms of improving this community. Ray was a mechanical guy, too. He knew the pressure behind all the fire hydrants in town. So he wasn't just a dreamer. He was a technician and excellent in both regards.
Great. How would you characterize the receptivity of the commission at the time in April 1967 when the Fair Housing Ordinance was brought up to you. Was it greeted with a fairly open mind, or were there set positions already, do you think?
You know, with the passage of that ordinance, I was amazed, I think all of our commissioners were amazed, at how little organized or even how little outspokenness was there was denying the validity of that as a thing a community should be about. I think there were those that probably quietly didn't like for it to happen, but they didn't articulate a case, nor did they try.
Was fair housing, would you say, an issue that was at all on your radar, or something that you felt like was a concern of the public, or were you, did you anticipate that that was an issue that was going to come up to the commission?
I don't know what my anticipation might have been, or any of our commissioners. With near unanimity, when addressed to this as a problem, with near unanimous consent, the commission agreed that that was a problem that we had. I don't know how far-sighted we were in anticipating that. I wouldn't want to exaggerate our capacities, but once it was presented to us, people that objected were almost all the people that objected were just a few realtors, and only a few of them.
There was actually a group called the Lawrence Fair Housing Coordinating Commission. I don't know whether you remember them at all, but they were kind of an umbrella organization of the NAACP, the League of Women Voters, the United Church Women of Lawrence. I know probably as a city commissioner, you may have met periodically with some of those kinds of community groups. Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of the particular issues or concerns that they would bring up to you, or was fair housing one of them, or is it so long ago that it's difficult to remember?
Fair housing was one, and there were other issues, but I would be remiss in thinking that I remembered much.
Okay. Obviously, the Human Relations Commission played a pretty important role in both constructing the ordinance and then in making the case for it to the commission. And they had just had it presented to them as a proposal by this Fair Housing Coordinating Commission in January, and then presented it to the commission in April. How would you characterize the relationship between the City Commission and the Human Relations Commission in that time frame? Was it a group you all trusted their judgment? I know it was a number of fairly prominent citizens in town.
Fred Six articulated the Human Relations Commission goals eloquently. Fred was a bright young attorney then, later become, as we know, a Kansas Supreme Court justice. Fred presented his commission's views in such an articulate, understandable, reasoned way that you would have to be pretty stubborn not to listen carefully.
Very good. And he was really the primary author, and I asked him how that fell into his lap. Was either because he was the secretary of the Human Relations Commission or the fact that he was an attorney, but he ended up being really the primary author of the ordinance.
I don't think we changed one word in the ordinance as he presented it to us.
Okay. And it was interesting that he modeled it after, and I don't know whether you recall this, but a great deal of it was modeled after Iowa City.
We felt we were the number two city in the country. I don't know that we were, but we felt that we were.
Yeah. Well, So you don't recall that there was any effort to wordsmith or fight over any of the wording, that it was pretty well accepted as it was written?
I think exactly as it was written.
Okay.
That's my memory.
Yeah. There were a couple of things in the ordinance that I just wanted to ask you a question about. One was, and I don't think this was unusual compared to other similar ordinances, but one of the penalties for a violation was 30 days in jail.
I don't remember that.
I was just going to ask you, it sounded like something that maybe the real estate agents would have found a little controversial.
Some of my protagonists might have enjoyed my being in jail at least 30 days.
Yeah. Another thing that was in the ordinance, and this was kind of interesting, it was sort of a kind of a positive appeal to the goodwill of the people of Lawrence, but it said, "The city of Lawrence is a center of culture whose democratic principles are being constantly observed by foreign students and visitors from all over the world." And then it went on to kind of use that as a justification for why we should have fair housing in the city. Was that kind of larger consideration something that the commission viewed persuasively?
I think so.
So really, the city's reputation was, besides just doing the right thing, the city's reputation was certainly something of concern.
We represented the flagship university in the state of Kansas, and for, honestly, several states around, and that we should, as a community, be so far behind an enlightened university attitude was offensive to many of us, right, wanting to call Lawrence our home.
And I don't know whether you recall, but both, I think it was the Vice Chancellor Surface, wrote a letter. Jim Surface wrote a letter to the commission at the time supporting the ordinance and saying it conformed with the university's housing policies at that time, which had gone through their own process of evolution until they had finally embraced non-discrimination and university housing. But also Ted Owens, who was then the basketball coach, wrote you all a letter and said how important this was to him, because when he went out to recruit athletes, he would promote Lawrence as a city which would be desirable for them, and particularly selling it to their parents, that it would be desirable to having their student-athlete attend the university there. So was the university's support important to you all in the process?
Oh, very much so. As a sidebar to that, I later appointed Ted, with support of the commission, to the Human Relations Commission. And I imagine 35 to 50 faculty members, many of whom I didn't know, came to me with their support. And maybe of those 50, only two of the 50 would not support the ordinance.
Interesting. You made a comment that was quoted in the Journal World, I think, at the time that the ordinance was presented to you, in which you praised it as, quote, "a magnificent piece of work." So obviously, you personally were quite pleased with the product that the Human Relations Commission had brought up to you. Do you think that was a reflection of, again, kind of the open-mindedness of the commission, or recognition of the quality of work that the Human Relations Commission had done in putting it together?
The commission was a gifted commission, in my judgment, and I think with perhaps only one minor exception on the city commission, that was felt.
Okay. When the commission held hearings, and I know none of your meetings were devoted strictly to this issue, but in going back and reading the newspaper accounts, at one meeting you all heard the proponents, and then at a separate meeting the mostly real estate business representatives came in to speak in opposition. Were you simply persuaded by one case over the other, or...
I think even in the case of the real estate community, and I don't think the majority of that community was represented by those opposed to the ordinance, I think the basis for their objections were so shallow, in our judgment, simplistic, and out of date, that they were easily overlooked. I think our votes were unanimous, always supportive of the ordinance, and in a way trying to assure Realtor X that this wouldn't ruin him.
Right. I'm going to mention some names to you of people who may have played an important role, just to help stimulate your memory and tell me, you know, what your impressions of them were and the role they played. We've already talked about Fred Six. But another person who's been mentioned as helping to sell the case was Glenn Kappelman, who was a realtor himself and a member of the Human Relations Commission and was very supportive of fair housing. Do you recall how he may have influenced you?
An elegant, lovely human with all the right instincts.
Another person that was brought up by Fred Six, who he thought played an important role just because he was such a prominent local businessman, was Mike Ghetto, who I guess owned the Eldridge at the time.
His Mike Ghetto Sr.'s father-in-law owned the Eldridge.
Okay.
Billy Hudson.
Okay.
And then his Mike Ghetto's son served 2 years on the city commission with me, and I still maintain a friendship with him. He lives in California. I think the balance of my fellow commissioners are all now gone.
Mm, that's too bad. Another name that comes up frequently as a leader in the African-American community, who also I think helped make the case for the need of the ordinance because he was a victim himself of housing issues, was Jesse Milan.
Jesse was a well-qualified educator, articulate, deserving of a place on the commission. He ran and did not get elected. I think Lawrence suffered as a result of that.
Okay. Another individual who came forward was Homer Floyd, former KU athlete, who at that time was serving as the director of the Civil Rights Commission for the state of Kansas.
A gifted young man, not only on the football field, but intellectually.
Very good. So it sounds as if there was very much of a cross-section of support, which must have felt given you confidence as you move forward. And fairly narrow opposition that clearly was not convincing to the commission at the time.
Well, we made a lot of friends from that effort that we probably would never have made otherwise.
Okay. I'm going to ask you one fairly specific question, and if you simply don't recall this, that's fair. But there was actually a newspaper article that mentioned a meeting at John Emick's home with the city attorney and some other city commissioners in late June, in which there was some discussion of possible changes to the ordinance. And do you recall that at all?
I don't recall that. I don't think I must have been a part of that meeting.
Yeah, I'm just...
Now, Commissioner Emick served the commission beyond my term.
Okay.
So it might be that that was after my... Yeah. Tenure, I'm not sure.
Okay. Would that have been unusual that business meetings were being held informally like that?
Yeah, I'm surprised that it happened because that would be unheard of.
Okay. There was also some mention that a couple of people suggested that the ordinance should have been put to a public referendum. Was there ever any consideration of that, or did you ever feel any pressure to do that?
Not by this commission. There might have been voices outside, but not in this commission.
So no discussion among yourselves that you would ever have considered doing that?
We were so unanimous in our thinking, both appointed commissions and elected commissions.
Very good. Did you have any concerns about what the public reaction would be, whether there'd be any negative reaction towards that, or did you feel?
From the drugstore soda fountain point of view, there was very little mention made, very little.
Good. So given the passage of the Fair Housing Ordinance and the fact that there didn't seem to be much overt opposition to it, would you say, and I think we've already kind of touched on this, but if you could just elaborate on your thoughts, that the community in general, other than some small group of voices, was fairly receptive to change?
I think they were almost inattentive, nonplussed. This ordinance only affected those people in the commercial area. Residential commercial area. It didn't affect private homeowners. It didn't affect a person that had a spare bedroom that they would rent to a student.
Right.
So unlike the swimming pool, which affected taxpayers, affected your sense of race, being in a swimming pool with a black body, that affected a much larger segment of the community.
Right. And since you bring up the swimming pool, it was later in 1967 that the bond finally passed to build the public swimming pool. But that was, I think, on the third attempt.
Yeah.
what was, would you say, was the nature of the opposition that caused it to fail the first two times? Was it race concerns, or was it simply the public not wanting to put forward the money, or a little of both?
I think it was 80% race and maybe 20% economics.
Okay.
I enjoyed my interaction with merchants. The radio station gave me a microphone. I went up and down the street addressing individual merchants and putting the mic in their face and saying, aren't you supportive of the swimming pool? And they didn't dare say no. Mm.
And I was going to ask you the next question is, what do you think finally turned the corner in late 67 when that bond initiative passed? And you said it passed fairly narrowly, but what
quite
finally
narrowly.
Got it over the top?
Well, I think the community conscience prevailed. I think it was a slow-coming thing, evidenced by the previous rejections. This, as I recall, got a tremendous turnout from the Lawrence public. Everyone felt they had a little stake in this election.
Good. And you mentioned you going around with a microphone to put some business owners on the spot. Do you remember any other efforts of proponents to try and get out the vote and convince people to vote in favor?
Well, I don't remember anything specifically.
Okay. A few months before the bond passed, I think in the late summer of 67, the city rented a swimming pool in West Lawrence and mm-hmm. made it available to the public as an integrated pool. Do you remember any of the specifics behind what motivated that?
Well, no. I think it was a suggestion. It was easily accepted as a good idea. It was a very hot summer, I recall that, and it was such a partial solution as to not be thought of as any kind of a solution, really.
Okay. There's actually a story that's related, and I think it's in Rusty Monholland's book about the 60s in Lawrence, in which sometime late in that summer there were threats by some African-American youth towards violence based on a number of their complaints, but one of which was not having access to a swimming pool. And so there was some suggestion in his book that the commission might have acted because of concerns that they wanted to head off violence. Is that your recollection at all?
No.
Okay. Do you have a sense that after both the passage of the Fair Housing Ordinance, the passage of the swimming pool bond, that had kind of created momentum towards addressing other aspects of discrimination and segregation in Lawrence? Did you sense that there was a growing amount of community support?
I don't think I had much of a sense of anything. I was just willing to accept what had happened.
Right.
And that was, to me, the representation of progress. I didn't know where to go from there.
Right. We already talked a little bit about some individuals who kind of played an important role in both promoting the Fair Housing Ordinance. Do you recall any other individuals that come to mind, either in that respect or in the civil rights movement in general, who were promoting change, or in the swimming pool issue? Anybody else who, I just want to make sure you have an opportunity to recognize any other individuals who you thought played a positive role?
You certainly touched on some important ones. Oh, I remember Cliff Calvin, a lovely human, a colleague of Glenn Kappelman's. Cliff was very supportive in the insurance and real estate business. And there were a number of Bob, oh my, you're stretching my ancient memory. Bob Charlton was another supportive person. Up and down the street, I think Julius Marks owned Marks Jewelry Store. I think Art Weaver, quietly supportive. There were a number. I'm sorry to only name a few when there were many.
Great. Let me just see if I we've kind of covered a number of things. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about national events, such as, you know, things like in 1968, the assassination of Martin Luther King. Did you see that particularly as we got into the late 60s and there was turmoil in the country, and some of that may have spilled over into some of the unrest in Lawrence, how did you see the community's perceptions of larger national issues and how they influenced what happened in the community?
Interesting. As a sidebar, our commission was meeting with some aggrieved black citizens in the building on Massachusetts, the Senior Center, and someone came in the room and whispered in this lovely black lady's ear that Martin Luther King had just been killed. She was there to protest her father, who had been on the garbage truck for 20-some years, never allowed to drive the truck, even though he'd never had an accident. He was always on the back end of the truck. Now he was too old to be jumping up and down off that truck and back on, and wondering why her father was where he was.
Hmm. Yeah. And you had mentioned in, I think, when you were interviewed by Rusty Monholland, that, and you actually brought up that meeting in which the word came to the community that Martin Luther King had been assassinated. And you said in the book, or he quoted you as saying, that when you saw the reaction of the members of the African American community that was there that night, that you came to the realization that things were about to change in Lawrence. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit and kind of characterize their reaction what you saw in their eyes that led you to know that this was a groundbreaking event that was going to lead to change?
Well, it was, to me, visceral. I couldn't point to a single thing except what kind of a commission would not address that girl's father. Hmm. And we did.
Yeah, good. And I think often it's the little things like that that end up adding up and making a difference over time. Were you surprised, and this would have been mostly after your tenure on the city commission, but were you surprised at the kind of unrest and violence that broke out in the late 60s and early 70s in the city and on campus?
Well, I'm really not surprised, because the nation was rising up against the Vietnam War. And we had a concentration of people that age group who were going to be vitally and perhaps terminally, fatally affected. And so the emotions ran very high. Not at all surprising.
Yeah.
Keeping a lid on somehow was the challenge.
Right. And I've talked to a couple of members of the, I don't know whether you remember Ron and Don Dahlquist, members of the police department, and they...
Twins.
Yeah, yes, they are. And they described the challenges they faced in a very small police department.
Very small.
That was trying to handle this unrest. And some of the descriptions that I've read of the violence, you know, gunfire in Lawrence, did the city seem like a very dangerous place, and did order seem to be highly tenuous for the average citizen that you kind of lived in a bit of fear?
It didn't affect me that way. I bet it did some. I was young enough to be bulletproof, and maybe if I'd been my age now, I would have been more concerned. In terms of affecting the larger community, I can't hardly believe that we felt that way. We knew the affected population and almost had to stand aside. Didn't know how to remedy.
Right. So it just kind of had
that war.
Yeah. Kind of had to let it burn itself out and let the frustrations be unleashed, and then hopefully order would eventually be restored. Do you feel like, as a longtime member of the community, that after that very difficult period was over, did it play in an unfortunate way any positive role in continuing to promote change in Lawrence?
I'd have to study that as a question.
Okay.
I don't have a ready answer.
Yeah. I think often change is, incremental and sometimes difficult to measure, other than things like the swimming pool, obviously, was one that was very visible and affected people immediately. But many other changes, like probably to the fair housing ordinance.
There might have been a few dozen other incremental changes.
Right.
So slight as to be hard to remember.
Right, right. In reflecting back on the role you played as a member of the Lawrence City Commission for 4 years, what accomplishments are you most proud of?
Oh, I think those two. I think my public service career is wrapped up with those two.
Very good. Thinking back on that fairly tumultuous period and the struggles of people to bring about change, what do you think young people today can learn from that and take away as lessons in terms of promoting social change and community activism today to try and make Lawrence or any community a better place?
Well, I'm pleased that we're so far advanced from where we were in the era that we're talking about here today. Certainly there are mountains yet to be climbed, but we're in better shape now.
Right.
And progress is yet to be made.
Yeah. One thing that's fairly evident in going back and looking at how the fair housing issue worked its way up to finally getting to the Human Relations Commission and then to the City Commission is that it was very much, or in very many respects, kind of a bottom-up, community-based movement that involved organizations, as I mentioned before, the NAACP, the League of Women Voters. There was a group called the League for the Promotion of Democracy, other groups like that. Do you believe that kind of community-based social activism is a way to bring about positive change, even though it can sometimes take a long time?
Well, I certainly thought that in that era past. I was an enthusiastic member of the Elizabeth Ballard Center, North Lawrence, Penthouse, Cottonwood headquarters. Those were properly motivated and represented advances in our communities and attitude. So yes, I'm enthusiastic in that sort of effort. Yeah.
Are you still involved in any of those kinds of efforts?
No, I became too long of tooth.
But I'm sure you probably are still associated with people who are, and I know you represent a member of the community who's had a long history of trying to bring about positive change. So.
Well, with the help of my grandsons, and we still enjoy contributing to all those things we can manage.
Great. Well, I have come to the end of my questions. I just want to give you the opportunity, if there's anything we didn't cover or any other stories you remember that you want to have the opportunity to relate while you're here, I open the floor up to you for anything you'd like to add.
Tom, it's been a good visit. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh, great. Well, thank you very much. And again, thank you for participating in our project, and thank you for the important role you played in bringing about the Fair Housing Ordinance in Lawrence.
Minimal.
All right, sir.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.